96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. Your questions or comments, toll free at 855-288-4876. Now, Insight.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. The school-to-prison pipeline is a phrase that has worried many a black family. It's also a point of serious discussion during this week, which is, of course, the National Black Child Development Week. It is a concern in the American educational system, but does it really end or begin, I should say, earlier than middle or elementary school? Does it begin in preschool? Well, we're talking about that tonight, and my guests are Tobika Green. She is president and CEO of the National Black Child Development Institute, and Carolyn Charles, thank you so much, our early childhood specialist and master educator here in D.C. If you have a question or a comment about the school-to-prison pipeline, what can be done about it, please give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Ladies, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Let me start with you, Tobika. Are we failing young black children in America even as early as preschool?
Well, when we think about the preschool to prison pipeline, there's one number I always ask everyone to remember, 250. Every day, 250 preschoolers are suspended or expelled in American schools. And so when we wonder, when we ask that question, are we failing? We're definitely not setting our children up for success when we are removing them from the learning environment.
How old is a child in preschool?
Three.
Okay, so let's back up just a minute, because that may be something that's really difficult for people to get their heads around. Because usually, being a father myself, when I think of a three-year-old, I think of someone who's only now just learning how to speak, still trying to get her legs together and coloring and Play-Doh and all of that. But you said 250 are suspended or expelled?
Every day.
How do you suspend or expel a three-year-old?
So you take us to what research has identified. So we're delving now into the research. In 2016, Dr. Walter Gilliam out of Yale released a study that actually helped us understand that these suspensions are not informed so much by children's behavior, but they're informed by implicit bias. And so it is the teacher, the educator in the classroom's reaction that is leading to the suspensions and expulsions. And so Dr. Gilliam's study actually tracked the eyes of the educators. And these were diverse educators. And what they found is that they are watching black boys and black girls. I should note that black boys are suspended 3.6% at a 3.6% higher rate than their white peers. And so our children are being watched in a manner that then draws that attention in. And with that attention, they're sometimes being suspended or often for behaviors that are either equal to their peers or even lesser, as teachers might say, offenses. So there's a significant role for implicit bias.
But Carolyn, as an educator.
Yes.
And you've been in the classroom.
Yes.
I remember teachers controlling their classrooms very well, particularly when you were talking about preschool. So what has happened?
So I believe what's happened at this point is that we need to continue to look at the curriculum that our early childhood professionals are being given. The idea is to provide them with those strategies and those things that will afford them the opportunity to not see behavior as something that needs to be taken, where children are taken out of the classroom, but rather where they're able to work with a child who may or may not have issue or concern while in the classroom. Sometimes it's not even about them actually having any issue or concerns in their behavior. It's just how you see them. And so with this idea, we need to be very reflective about who we are and what we bring to the classroom as early childhood professionals.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline. How early does it actually start? What can be done about it to keep Black children from getting a get-into-jail card for free? The thing that I find interesting is you said, you know, depending on, you know, the curriculum and how that impacts preschool. Help me with this, because that doesn't make sense to me. I'm thinking what you teach should have nothing whatsoever to do with how you relate to the child. Am I wrong here?
Well, the idea is not so much what you teach, but who are you when you're teaching? Mm-hmm. So your pedagogy, what do you know? How do you assist and how do you work with children that are in your classroom? One of the things we always go back to in early childhood is the Perry Preschool Study or the Perry Preschool Project, which said if you have a quality education and you have students who are part of programs that are providing quality, that, of course, meaning teachers who have gotten the degrees and rather the experiences in the university realm, that they have now been provided with strategies, techniques, pedagogy that affords them the opportunity to meet children where they are. This study also found that it was a longitudinal study that found that if you received a quality education, you were more likely to have higher earnings and committed fewer crimes, because the idea was you received that foundation of a quality early childhood programming that afforded you that which you needed to be successful in life.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about the school to prison pipeline. How early does it start? You were going to say something.
I wanted to add to Carolyn. It is the pedagogy, but it also is the overall teacher preparation and then an educator's ability to see the humanity of the children who sit in front of them. We're always troubled when we hear an adult educator say that a 3 or 4 year old was intimidating.
Right.
Right,
and that's exactly, and I think you said it a whole lot better than I could, because again, in my mind, we are talking about children,
babies.
Exactly. So what has happened to, is this the educational system that is falling down? Are we changing how we view children? Babies?
Well, I think you have to step back and ask, what informs one's perception of those that they're engaging? Right? And so it's not simply the education system, right? It's the broader society. And how Black children, Black people are seen is definitely informing this. Thus, the role of implicit bias. That's why a 3-year-old can be frightening.
But is that, now when you talk about bias, is this Black and brown children versus white teachers, or is this just teachers across the board and how Black and brown children are viewed?
So the numbers actually show that it is across the board that Black children are being watched more frequently. And so it's both. You know, I can't say, oh, no, it's only white teachers, never Black teachers, never brown teachers. There were consistent findings in Walter Gilliam's study.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about the school to prison pipeline. Does it start earlier than middle or even elementary school? Does it actually start in early childhood education? Give us a call. Lines are open. Let's talk to Pop. Pop, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
How you guys are doing?
Doing just fine.
Wonderful.
Okay. Yeah, I have a comment and then I think a question. But the first comment I have is because I work in DCPS, DC Public Schools, and before we get into the blame game in terms of pointing accusations at teachers, let's first make sure that the parents and the communities these kids come from, they're sending us some coachable kids. That's the first thing. But the comment or the question that I wanted to know is that today it seems like the young people, because of technology and cell phones and what have you, the kids don't seem to have an attention span. So I was wondering, is there some way to rework the education so that kids don't have to open up a book and go paragraph by paragraph to learn things, because it doesn't seem like the kids are actually interested in learning the book or reading the book to gain knowledge. They'd rather go another route to gain knowledge. And I just wanted to know if you had any.
I think that's a great question. Coach, thank you, Pop. Coachable kids, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Pop, technology is being integrated into classrooms across the country, and definitely into early childhood classrooms as well. We are joined by Carolyn, and she is the master educator, so I'll let her speak a bit more to that.
The idea that we want to infuse more technology in the classroom may not be where we want to go with this. The thought would be, though, that we continue to see how we can utilize technology in a positive way, but always go back to the foundation of reading the book.
Yes.
When you have the opportunity to have that three-year-old next to you sitting on a carpet and you're reading a story and you're using those inflections and your eyes are wide and your tone changes, they are involved, they are interested, and they will continue to learn that way if, as you started to say, with parents being given those tools as well. One of the things we've watched and seen, parent involvement makes a huge difference in what happens with young children. And you're absolutely right. If we give them those tools and we provide them with those strategies, they will be able to come in ready to learn.
But if I may ask, but isn't yesterday's blackboard today's whiteboard? Yesterday's paperback or hardback book today's tablet?
But think about what it feels like to have someone read you a poem.
Oh, absolutely. So
that still holds true. That still has a profound effect on how children learn. They still want that human interaction. Early childhood is about caring and socialization and what happens with young children when social and emotional development is a part of the curriculum. And so if we keep that in mind and we keep that as the forefront of what we do, then we'll let technology have its place, but it will never be how we start or end our program.
And if I just may add one more thing with Pop and family engagement, what research tells us is where there are engaged families, caregivers, there are high performing schools. And so, yes, there is a role for families, for parents, for caregivers. But let's remember, this is a partnership. Yes. It's the educator and the broader family and ecosystem. And so when we work collaboratively, we see positive outcomes for our children.
202-319-7810. We're talking about the school to prison pipeline. What is it? What can you do as an educator, as a parent, as a community to keep black children from getting that go to jail free card? Let's talk to Leslie. Leslie calling from Lanham. Hey, Leslie, what's on your mind?
Okay, so here's what I like to say concerning this issue. One, I think educators need to keep in mind that they have developing children in the classroom, right? And so when you have developing children in your classroom, you need to keep focused that they are developing. Once you put them in an environment where they are now subjected to reaching benchmarks, I think you're headed in the wrong direction, because children are not able to learn naturally as they develop. So I think, for example, when they're in the classroom and you require them to sit down, to me, that's antithetical to the stage of development that they're in, right? If they're 3 years old, they're just coming out of their terrible twos. So to put them in an environment where they're required to sit and do these things that other people have mastered because they're older and they have developed, I think that's the wrong approach.
Thank you so much for your comment, Leslie. I need to take a break. And on the other side, if you want to hold on and hear the response from my guests, you're certainly welcome to do that. We are talking about black child development and the school to prison pipeline. How do you keep your children from heading in the wrong direction when it comes to early childhood education? Please stay with us. If you have a question, if you have a comment, this conversation, and it's a good one, it will continue on the other side of this break. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you can't get through, please keep trying. I promise we will take your phone calls. And for those of you who want to know more about the National Black Child Development Institute. You can find them online at nbcdi.org. That's nbcdi.org. And of course, that information will be on whur.com after the program. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're asking, does the school-to-prison pipeline begin even earlier than middle or elementary school? It's a question under consideration during National Black Child Development Week. We're talking about it with Tobika Green. She is president and CEO of the National Black Child Development Institute, and Carolyn Charles, early childhood specialist and master educator here in the District of Columbia. Let's go back to that conversation before the break. Either of you want to react to what Leslie was talking about in early development of children?
When we think about benchmarks and we think about standards and we think about what children should be doing, the idea of that coming into play was probably brought in during No Child Left Behind. And so we were looking at how do we have teachers be held accountable for what's happening with young children. Subsequently, we've moved away from that. Right now, we are looking at those benchmarks, but we're looking at them because we have to have something that says, where are we taking them? So I would say to you, the idea is we as early childhood professionals have said it is very important that we look and have those sorts of standards that allow us to look at children, as you said, holistically and where they are. And so the benchmarks are not simply to have them sit and listen and those sorts of things. It's providing them with opportunities to do what needs to be done in the early childhood classroom so that they can discover, explore, and then figure out how they can be a part of the curriculum. So that is what we ask for parents to look for. That's what we ask for parents to kind of seek out when looking for quality programs, that they're deliberate about looking for programs that afford their child the opportunity to discover and learn at the same time.
So, Carolyn, I love that you said that it is very much about the whole child. And when we think whole child, we have to focus on the social emotional development of children as well. And so that is critical to a child's overall success. And so we want to ensure in all of the structure that may be provided that, again, as we look at the humanity of the child, that we don't lose the importance of social and emotional development.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Leslie, thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Thomas calling from Fairfax, Virginia. Thomas, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. Always enjoy listening to the show.
Thank you.
To me, and the two ladies that are on, I can tell, are exceptional educators. But as parents, I could be, you know, if I had one of them as a teacher, but I come to school without breakfast, it doesn't matter how good of a teacher you are, I'm going to struggle. I think we as Black people have got to bring about awareness of the importance of mom and dad raising our children. Like you said, without parents, these kids, especially young Black men, are like baby, you know, zebras out on a safari being plucked from society because they have absolutely no advocate to stick by them.
So Thomas,
you get what you get.
So, Thomas, this is Tobika. Carolyn is the master educator. I've never taught in a classroom in America. I am an advocate. Our organization is committed to improve and advance the quality of life for Black children and families through education and advocacy. And so with that, we work directly with families.
I'm not sure I understand the zebra bit. What, clarify that, Tom. I'm trying not to be insulted, so help me with that.
Yes, sir. So to the point you talked about our kids being plucked away, you are absolutely right. Prison, you know, school to prison, you've got individuals, you've got certain areas of society that looks for young men of color that go along the wrong route in life and they're easily sucked into a life of getting a felony, getting locked up, getting out, and it makes it really difficult to not repeat that same cycle. Inability to get a good job, to get educated. So what else will I choose to do but sell drugs? So I just feel like if a kid doesn't have, you know, someone at home that can call the school, speak up for that child, they're subject to be slaughtered, just like prey, you know, in the jungle.
I see. Okay.
And that's why, so the National Black Child Development Institute launched Delivering on the Promise to ensure that just that is happening. This is all about families, caregivers, but concerned members of the community advocating on behalf of our children. We know if they start with suspensions and expulsions in preschool, they have a higher percentage of incidents of incarceration. And so we're trying to end it now. And we're doing it in partnership with parents, caregivers, clergy, community leaders, and the educators in the classroom. The work of the National Black Child Development Institute, specifically through our Family Empowerment Program, is to engage with our parents, ensure they have the information and data to hold the schools, the early learning centers accountable, and ensure that they are eliminating these policies that lead to suspensions and expulsions. That's where we start.
But Carolyn, my question, piggybacking on what he's saying, isn't child advocacy one of the foundations of teaching?
It is. And so as he was speaking, is it Harold?
Yeah. I'm Harold.
Thomas.
That's Thomas.
Sorry, Thomas. Yeah. The idea would be that we look at what's happening within our programs because our teachers are there for this as well. We are told to assist and help and work with families and come together to make sure that our students, our children, are having all that they need to receive quality care and education. That then being said, we work very diligently with our parents so that we can foster that which needs to be done for our children.
So, Carolyn, that's utopic to me. Like, that's utopia. That is what should happen. But you've been in enough classrooms to know that's not what's happening. I mean, even as we look at teacher preparation, there's limited, right, attention given to effective family engagement. And so this isn't pointing fingers at educators. This is saying that we do have to rethink the preparation process. We work with educators across the country. We know that the programs that they're receiving their bachelor's, their credentials in, are not effectively equipping them to deal with diverse parents from diverse backgrounds.
But let me ask this, because it seems that this conversation is building a three-legged stool with this child sitting on it. You've got teachers, you have families, and then you have community. And I would argue that whether a child comes from an affluent community or a challenged environment, that if any one of those three legs is broken, that the child will still not learn.
You're absolutely
well
right.
Stated, and so, Harold, yes.
With that being said, I have had the pleasure of working in programs that have afforded me the opportunity to have all three be a part of what is being what's happening. And so working in New York City, working in Prince George's County, as well as Alexandria City, and then working here in the District of Columbia, I have seen many programs that have all of these pieces in place, starting from the Head Start programs. The Head Start programs, that is the way it is built. That is what has to happen. All of these pieces must be in place in order for our children to succeed. And so that is usually the foundation that is used to build a quality program.
So I total respect for Head Start, for early Head Start as well. But we know that we're finding the trend of pre-K moving into public schools. And we do not find that same evidence-based approach necessarily being practiced in those schools.
And that is why it's so essential that we look at our teacher preparation programs.
Yes.
And
yeah,
our teacher preparation programs, one in which I'm a part of here in the District of Columbia, we stress the importance of making sure that all of these pieces are in place.
If I may, I want to go back to the phone lines. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Daryl calling from D.C. Thanks for hanging on, Daryl. What's on your mind?
Well, my question was, if a preschooler is actually being suspended, is it really more of a punishment for the parent because now they have to find child care or anything? I just don't see how a child that young is interpreting that as immediate punishment when it's happening the next day.
So it definitely has a negative impact on children and their overall well-being. But you are correct in saying the impact that it has on the family. Families miss work because they must stay home, or they then go and search for a different child care center or program. And so it impacts the entire family.
And I think one of the things that Daryl said that I thought was a very, very brilliant point, if you are in preschool and the teacher says, Johnny, if you don't sit down, you're going to be suspended, a 3-year-old is going to say, what's that?
Right.
So.
And if the teacher says you have to go home, it may be like, yay.
Okay, good. Because now I've got G.I. Joe with Kung Fu Grip to play with when I go home. And so it just seems to me that being punitive for 3 and 4 year olds does no good at all. What is the answer for addressing these issues outside of expelling or suspending a 3 or 4 year old?
As the master educator chimes in, I want to posit that there is no evidence supporting the effectiveness or efficacy of suspensions and expulsions as an intervention. So that's just period across the board.
Unless the child is older and scared of daddy. Funny, yes, but true. Uh-huh. Because if you say that you're going to be suspended or suspelled or expelled or even put in detention and you have to tell your father, going to do that again. If you do have that proper foundation at home. But to my other question, if I can, Carolyn, what's the option for suspension and expulsion of a 3 or 4 year old?
It's looking at our public school systems who are now opening their doors to our 3 and 4 year olds and asking them to really take a look at those things that they put in place for disciplinary action. The idea of taking 3 and 4 year olds into what we used to call big school is a new phenomenon. The idea of keeping them within the community-based programs where you find persons who have been taught to be nurturing, who have been taught to work with that child until they are able to do what is asked of them in the way in which they have been asked. When you move them into the public school system and the alternative for a child that is misbehaving is suspension, is expulsion, then they say to themselves, well, we can do it too. And you really can't, because as we've said, development says they're not ready for some of what you're asking them to do. And because of that, we have to look to see, have we provided them with all the technique, all the strategies, all the ways in which they can be successful in the classroom? So for me, it goes back to teacher preparation. It goes back to, what do our teachers have? What has been put in place for them? Are they able to look within themselves and do some self-reflection to say, have I given this child everything that they need in order to be successful? And so with that, we look at our programs at our local universities to make sure that they are providing these tools to our teachers.
Sarah, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Sarah. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'd just like to make a couple of comments. One, in respect to the 3 years being suspended from school, I worked in the school system for a number of years, and I currently work in a pediatrician's office. But I think as society and the community, we have allowed schools to implement rules and laws in school where 3-year-olds, where we know they love to play with guns, particularly boys, so that if you even draw a picture of a gun, you can be suspended. If you even show your finger as if you're making a picture of a gun, that will also get you suspended from school. My second thing is that a lot of parents are in denial about their child's development. When a pediatrician, I know particularly in my office where I work, when parents, and particularly our parents of color, when they are informed about their child's development with respect to the scale that the pediatricians have, they always say that's a scale for white people. And I say to them, that is not a scale for white people, because my children all met that scale or exceeded on that scale, and I'm not a white person.
Mm.
So
Sarah,
I find that, that yes.
Well, I've got to take a break, but I appreciate you giving us a call and sharing your thoughts about it. But and thank you so much, and we'll be talking about that on the other side of this break. So thank you again. Need to take this break. When we come back, we're going to continue this discussion about early childhood education and the school to prison pipeline. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about the school to prison pipeline. Does it begin even earlier than middle or even elementary school? Let's go back to the phone lines. Rudy, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Rudy. What's on your mind?
Good evening, Mr. Fisher and distinguished guests. My name is Rudy Smith. I was raised in Harlem, New York, and I'm 61 years old. What I see going on now, and I think the root of this problem is that we have stopped as a community learning how to raise our children. People fail to realize that the school is nothing more and the teacher is nothing more than an instrument to polish your child for what the parent has already taught that child. But when you have two or three generations of parents that are full grown now that have no idea how to raise a child, do not discipline their children, it becomes a problem for the teacher, because now the teacher is more focused on that child that does not have discipline in their life. I worked 30 years in the prison system. I'm appalled of the American government allowing children to even enter an institution like that. I don't care if their mother or father is incarcerated or not. There should be an age limit to that. They should not be allowed to go in there as an infant. And the teachers need more power to be able to discipline a child that is wrong. And I don't believe expelling them is the case. A lot of times that child just probably needs a little bit more one-on-one attention.
Interesting. Rudy, thank you so much. Any thoughts about what Rudy was sharing with us?
Rudy said so much that is rich, just reminding us of the role that the family plays and the partnership there. We talk a lot now about the ecosystem. So it really goes beyond the parents and the caregivers. It's that broader community. You know, we talk a lot about the fractured community and that we no longer have the village, but we've got to go back and recapture that village. And what I'll say as it relates to if parents are not parenting, I'll say that at the National Black Child Development Institute, we're strengths-based. And so when we work with families, we start, one, honoring the culture and the experiences of the families we're engaging with. And then we build upon that in partnership with them. And so we can't simply accept, oh, they're not doing. That's just not true. There are parents, every parent loves and wants the best for his or her child. What we have to do as advocates and the organizations and educators working with them is meet them where they are and develop that partnership. And we, again, take it a step further at the National Black Child Development Institute, because in addition to assisting our parents in being, the first and best teachers for their children, we also want them to be advocates for their children.
But how can parents, or how do parents react to what sounds to me like an intervention?
So for us, it's not. We're culturally relevant. So we don't enter the room as experts. We enter the room as partners, other caring adults who are collaborating with them. And when it comes to our family empowerment program, it's been implemented with different groups. So there are the families who are active at an early childhood education center. There are families who may be in process to adopt or foster children. There are parents who may have lost their children are now in the process of preparing to receive them back into their homes. And so we're working to help to partner with them to build capacity.
And so what I would say in regards to how parents view intervention, it really depends on the rapport that the teacher has with the parent and the family. Rapport is essential. Relationships are essential. And that then being said, we walk in partnership with the parent. We sit together. We talk about what is working at home for you. What isn't working at home for you? How can we work together to, so that we are working to ensure that the children are hearing the same positive messages from both home and school, which will make a host of difference in what happens with them and their growth and development.
David, calling from DC. Thanks for calling, David. What's on your mind?
Hey, Harold. David, how you doing?
I'm doing good.
Great conversation. I think a missing element when we talk about parents, particularly when we look at early Head Start, Head Start, and early child, the work being done in early child, is I just think that there needs to be a greater and more specific focus on engaging fathers. I find that there are a lot of dads who want to be engaged, but particularly during the early child years, a lot of the outreach and focus is on mom. And I'm doing some work in both Baltimore and Atlanta, specifically working with dads in early Head Start. And because we've been reaching to dads, they're responding and they're participating. And so I'll hang up if interested in hearing what your experts have to say.
Thoughts about father involvement.
One of the initiatives as a center director, when I did spend my time working that way, we had something called Donuts for Dad, which was something that we did once a month. Once we started this process or this opportunity, dads, of course, would come in. Donuts were there for them. They dropped the children off and that sort of a thing would happen. It turned out to be one of the best things we could have done because they then started bringing the children to school. They then started wanting to be the ones to pick up if it were more possible. I remember walking out into my hallway and seeing five dads picking up their children at that time and just clapped. And they said, "What's going on, Ms. Charles? What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just happy that you're here." And then we put together a program where they came in as fathers to talk about their challenges and what was happening. And this was while I worked in a Head Start program. So again, this is part of what we did in that program. This is some of the initiatives that we would work to do. As an educator now working with teachers, these are the kinds of strategies, these are the kinds of techniques, these are the kinds of things I ask my teachers to keep in mind for when they walk into the classroom. Here is how you can get persons involved. Always keeping in mind, yes, we look to mom sometimes first, but never forget about that dad that is there in the home or the dad that may be in another home that you might need to coax out and into the program.
Amen, amen, and amen. I would just remind us as we're engaging our fathers, and I will say for our national affiliate network, we have 27 affiliates across the country. There's intentionality around the engagement of fathers, but remember to engage them, built on their assets. See that they're bringing assets. We're not simply structuring programs for them, but they're informing those programs and bringing the best of themselves into the setting as an equal partner.
David, thanks for your phone call. I've got a little bit of time left, and I definitely want to get this question in because this has kind of been sitting in my head for a few minutes now. In your opinion, Tabika, who is responsible for the bias that is contributing to this early part of the school to prison pipeline?
Who is difficult? What it is, unfortunately, built into our fabric, the idea that we are viewed differently. Last night, I was in Atlanta for the release of Being Black is Not a Risk Factor, Georgia. And so the point we make there is that the color of your skin is not what puts you at risk. It is innately just your state of being. It is how others then engage you as a result of the color of your skin. And so with that, it is the media. I mean, I can't point to a person, but it's all that is America that makes women cross the street when you're walking towards them, Harold, right? That the idea that our children are being watched solely because they're black. I mean, understand black boys make up 19% of preschool, but 45% of the suspensions and expulsions. You take black girls who make up 20% of preschool enrollment, but they're 54% of female preschool suspensions and expulsions. So it implicit bias plays its role. There is more research to come. But again, with Dr. Gilliam's study, just the eyes watching what the educators were watching.
I guess for me, what I had done in terms of my research was I took a look at a piece that came out just this week from York University that spoke to research stating that minority children themselves are having issue with this idea of implicit bias happening within their space and place. And what they took a look at and decided was it really depends on the social environment that the students are involved in. And if it is, their social environment dictates that they are the ones deemed to be the scapegoats in the classroom. They are the ones that are being chosen to seem to be the problem child in the classroom, then they will internalize that. And so it is so important for us to look at what is the social context for which our children are brought into the classroom, and what do they see themselves, or who do they see themselves as?
But in this last minute, do well-meaning Black parents unwittingly put that burden on their children by trying to educate the children about the difficulties of bias, prejudice, and racism in America?
I think we have to hold here the systems accountable. Right. This is why advocacy is so important. We have to end the practice where we find evidence of implicit bias and just unfair treatment of our children. We have to call for that end. And as I remind everyone, the power is in your ballot. Vote, because those are the people who are informing who your superintendents are. They're informing resource allocation and the like. And so a parent is the advocate, and the parent can hold the systems responsible.
Well, we could talk about this forever. And unfortunately, I suspect that this issue will be something that we will continue to discuss unless some of the things that both of you have suggested take place. But we hope that they do. But I do want to thank both of you, Tamika Green.
Thank
and
you, Harold.
Carolyn Charles, for coming in and talking to us. That is the Daily Drum on SiriusXM, Channel 141, for this Wednesday, May 16th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night. The Howard University.